Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's tribes today, where are they located when we come back. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. The government gets the other 60%. Now, that's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25%, and the government will net 75%. Did you get that? Your share goes up by a paltry few percentage points, and the government's goes up by about 25%. That means if we're working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more, or 8%, 8 crummy percent more take-home pay than you did this year, guaranteed by Congress and the IRS, and the government gets an additional 25%. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners, and that's where you're at $100,000 a year. 5% of income earners make $100,000 or more. And then you're going to net 25%? That's it? Why don't you call me today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it'll answer many of the legal questions you have about taxes and why it is we pay so much and receive so little. And let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Now, to order your free General Law CD package, just call the school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking this week about the tribes of Israel. Where are these lost tribes of Israel, as they're called in church and Sunday school? Where are they located? What are the modern nations today that we can identify them? And what are the traits and characteristics? Well, so far we've seen that the Ephraimites are located in Great Britain, and they're very arrogant people. They've got a number of attributes, you know, that we can hang on them, as we saw here when we looked at the Ephraimites, but they're arrogant. God, those Englishmen, they just, you talk about know-it-alls, and you talk about, hey, we run the world, and we're the world's greatest people. They're it. Now, the Americans, on the other hand, are very forgetful. We've forgotten our God. That's assuming we ever knew him. And we Americans, we can't remember 3 generations back. I mean, if you stop and think about it, what was your great-great-grandfather's name? You probably don't know. Where was he born? Where did he die? How old was he? What did he do for a living? You probably don't know. Now, the British do. I mean, they keep records in their genealogy. And then we got over to Reuben. Reuben, the firstborn, is in France, and they're licentious. I mean, they're sex perverts, and they've always been that way, and they don't deny it, and they live their lives just that way, and you see that down in New Orleans. They're kind of a decadent bunch of people. And those are the traits that were described in Bible prophecy in Genesis 49, and there's some other prophecies in addition to it, but Genesis 49, when Israel was blessing these children, telling them, well, here's the end time prophecy, comes right from God himself. Based upon your DNA, here's the way you people are going to turn out. Now, we were just finishing up on Reuben. I ran out of time last time, but in talking about Reuben the French, earlier it was mentioned that the decisive action by the tribe of Reuben may have saved Western Europe. Western Europe was saved by the Franks. And that episode occurred centuries before the modern era, when many Germanic and Gothic tribes were migrating into Europe from Asia after the fall of Parthia. The tribe known as the Franks settled in France. Now, the Franks gave their name to modern France, and in the previous chapter we discussed the invasion of Europe by Attila the Hun. Attila's Huns had conquered their way through Eastern and Central Europe, and they were invading Western Europe. The Visigoths, the Saxons, Germans, Burgundians, and the Goths had been pushed as far westward as they could go. They combined to fight Attila's Huns at the pivotal Battle of Chalon, located east of Paris. Now, the Western army was led by a Roman general named Aetius, A-E-T-I-U-S, I guess that's Aetius, who had been born as a member of the Vandal tribe. He was assisted by King Theodoric of the Visigoths. The forces of Aetius and Theodoric lifted the siege of Orleans and then prepared to fight the entire force of the Huns near Chalon, C-H-A-L-O-N-S. I imagine that's Chalon. The Encyclopedia Britannica says of this pivotal event, on the night before the battle, those Franks who favored Aetius broke through to him after a slaughter of 15,000 men. Now, S. Baring Gould's 1890 book on Germany adds the following. In the year 451, Attila marched west at the head of an enormous host of Huns, and they overran the south of Germany, crossed the Rhine, and resolved to conquer their way to the Atlantic. But the Franks, the West Goths, the Burgundians, and the Romans united in one great host under the general Aetius, and the battle was furious and ended in the defeat of the Huns. Attila was forced to retire with a loss of half of his men. Now, if Attila had won that battle, Western Europe would have been dominated by the Huns instead of by the Caucasian tribes who had migrated into Western Europe. And the role of the Franks in this case seems to be decisive. The first account indicates that the Franks fought through the enemy lines, apparently at a cost of 15,000 men, to join the Western forces under Aetius. This gives us an indication of the huge numbers involved in this battle. The Huns apparently had Aetius' forces surrounded. Why else would the Franks have had to fight their way through Attila's lines to reach their intended allies? That the Franks lost 15,000 men simply fighting through Attila's lines to join the Western allies indicates not only that the army of the Franks must have been very large to afford such a loss, but also that Attila's forces ringing Aetius' forces must have been immense. Now consider the effect that the arrival of the Franks would have had on the forces of Aetius and Attila. It would have greatly reinforced the forces of Aetius on the night before the battle, and it would have been a tremendous morale boost to the forces of Aetius to have the Franks successfully fight through Attila's Huns to join them on the eve of the battle. On the other hand, it would have deflated the morale of the Huns, and if the Franks had not intervened in the manner that they did, the Battle of Chalon may have been won by Attila, and the course of European history would have been altered forever. Now, the Franks were mostly Reubenites, the ancestors of what we call modern France today. Now, as the eldest son of Jacob, Reuben's portion was secondary only to the Ephraimites and Manassites. The French had a substantial empire of their own with many colonies and territorial possessions. While not a superpower, the independent nuclear arsenal of France gives it considerable power in the modern world. France, like the United States and Great Britain, is one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, and the French language is still dominant in many parts of the world to this day. Therefore, France exhibits both the power and the dignity which was prophesied for the Reubenites in Genesis chapter 49, as well as the Reubenite passion for things involving physical appetites. This book concludes that the nation of France and the other regions of direct French descent, such as French Canadian Quebec, constitutes the Israelite tribe of Reuben. So the French, aiding our rebellion against Great Britain, enabled us to defeat Britain in the Revolutionary War. If it hadn't been for the French, I don't think that the American colonies would have succeeded in breaking away. Now, the Canadians were a little smarter than we were. Instead of fighting with the British, they just waited until 1867 and accomplished the same goal politically. And I'm sure that had we not gone to war against Great Britain politically, we would have separated ourselves, just like the Canadians and the Australians have done over the years. America would probably be a Commonwealth country, independent in the same vein or in the same way. But we got a little uppity, and we said, hey, George, we're not going to put up with this anymore, and so we're leaving the ship. And he got a little uppity, and he said, well, no, you're not, and we had a hell of a scrap. And if you'll look through history, you'll find that the Israelites have oftentimes fought among themselves. As you see here in the book of Judges, as Collins pointed out here, that the Americans and the British were fighting clear back here in 1100 B.C. over a battle that had been fought and won. And when it was all said and done, the Americans put 46,000 of their brother Ephraimites to death by giving them that password and saying, okay, let's hear you say this word. And everybody that couldn't say the word, you know, you could do that to this day. You could take people from Texas out to California and say, hey, give me a sentence or give me a word, and those Texans, they'd flunk it every time. Or vice versa. You know, you could go down near to the South and bring a Californian in there and say this word, and that Californian would give himself away every single time. And we see that here in the United States, very common here in the United States. I mentioned that in the last program. I can tell people when they come from Pennsylvania or New York, Massachusetts, Texas, they have a very distinct, and especially, here's a good one, North Dakota. They always go a boat. They don't go about. They go a boat. And when you listen to them speak, it doesn't take very long, you figure out. Keep in mind that there are 60 million plus Germans in the United States. When we get to the tribe of Gad here in a little bit, we'll talk about those. But this is the next one here is called Zebulun. Zebulun, spelled Z-E-B-U-L-O-N. Write it down on your list and listen to this story. Z-E-B-U-L-O-N equals Holland. So all you people that live in Holland or your Dutch descent, you come from the tribes of Israel, and listen to Bible prophecy and what has happened in Holland. Zebulun was a younger brother of Reuben, and little information is provided about Zebulun in the Bible. The tribe of Zebulun formerly lived in the area west of the Sea of Galilee. After their relocation to Asia, they were one of the many related Saki tribes. Consequently, their migrations would have followed the larger tribes of Israel, first of all into Asia, and then later into Europe. Ordinarily, that would make it impossible to determine the location of the modern Zebulunites. However, the Bible gives us a very revealing clue concerning their identity in the modern world today. In fact, it is uncannily accurate in describing one modern European nation. I'm going to pause here and break in. Just recently, in both Archaeological Review and National Geographic, they've had articles, I would say in the last 5 years, concerning mummies that have been dug up in China. And these mummies that have been dug up in China have red beards, and they're obviously Europeans. And the question arises, well, where in the world did these people come from? Well, remember, our people were in Egypt, and they learned the embalming trade there. And then they migrated out of the Middle East, and they went into Asia. And, of course, the Saki and the Pythians, is it the Pythians? Yeah, I guess it's P-Y-T-H-I-A. Pythia is the name, I guess, of the kingdom, or the, trying to look for a word here, that not a tribe, but the congregation of tribes, and the empire was called Pythia. Anyway, they ranged clear out to the Indus River in India, and they went up into Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan and on into China, then to southern Russia, and then migrated to the west and ended up in Western Europe and Ireland and England, Scotland, the Scandinavians. We'll see here also the tribes of Israel. But the moral of the story is that we're now digging up these mummies in China, and everybody's scratching their head saying, well, where did these people come from? And the answer is they came out of the Middle East, migrated east into Asia, and then migrated out of Asia into Europe, and that's where they finally settled. Now Zebulun shall dwell in the haven of the sea, and he shall be for a haven of ships, and his borders shall be unto Zidon. Now that's recorded in Genesis 49 verse 13. Now a dictionary definition of the word haven includes the alternate meanings, any sheltered safe place, refuge, and a port or a harbor. Now the Bible prophesied that the Zebulunites would inhabit an area that was a haven, a shelter, or a refuge for ships from the sea. Now, since the Israelites migrated into Europe from Asia, we obviously need to look for a European nation that is on a sea coast and is sheltered from the sea. Now, readers may know which nation in Europe was bought back from the sea by way of its famous dikes. That nation is today called the Netherlands, known as Holland or the Dutch. Holland's land is quite literally sheltered from the sea by way of its dike system. So the prophetic description of a haven of the sea is strikingly apt. The phrase haven of ships indicates that the land of Zebulun must also include a major harbor facility. Indeed, the Amplified Bible translates this phrase as a landing place for ships. Now, does the Netherlands satisfy this requirement? The answer is emphatically yes, it does. The port of Rotterdam, Holland, became the busiest modern seaport in the world. And the Encyclopedia Americana tells us this, quote, its port in volume of freight handled is the largest in the world. In addition to foreign trade, the port handles the huge barge traffic that is carried on the Rhine River and associated waterways. The port now extends continuously from Rotterdam to the sea, and at the mouth of the new waterway lies the great port complex of Europort, unquote. Now, not only is Rotterdam the busiest ocean-going seaport, it is now a gateway to all of Europe by way of a system of interconnected canals on Europe's mainland. The above is sufficient to identify Holland as modern Zebulun. But a prophecy of Moses, recorded in Deuteronomy 33, verses 18 and 19, about the future of the tribe of Zebulun, gives even more support to this view. Here's what Moses said. Quote, of Zebulun, he said, they shall suck up the abundance of the seas and the treasures hidden in the sand. Unquote. Now, the Hebrew word translated suck is used elsewhere in the Bible to describe infants sucking milk out of a breast. Now, when an infant sucks milk from a breast, it drains or it empties the milk in the breasts. Moses prophesied that the Zebulunites would suck the seas and gain an abundance from doing so. The connection with Holland is obvious. The Dutch literally sucked out or drained the sea with their system of dikes and windmills, and they gained abundant land as a result. The phrase, treasures hidden in the sand, could be a second Dutch identification. What treasure, frequently hidden in the sand, is critically important in the modern world? And the answer is oil. And one of the largest oil companies in the world today is called Royal Dutch Shell. The Netherlands formerly had overseas colonies of its own, the largest of which was oil-rich Indonesia, known for centuries as the Dutch East Indies. Indonesia became independent of Holland after World War II and is now a member of OPEC. However, the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company has been one of the premier oil-producing companies of the world. It was also unique in that it bore the name of a specific European nation in its corporate title. And unlike Exxon, Standard Oil, Mobil Oil, and other firms, it's known today as Royal Dutch Shell. Now, the second portion of the prophecy in Genesis 49:13 is as cryptic as the first portion is clear. But since it is there, a possible decipherment will be proposed. What can be understood about the prophecy, "His border shall be unto Zidon"? So the following answer is speculative, but it does find a fulfillment in modern Holland. The key may lie in the Hebrew word that is translated border, which literally means thighs. And it is so translated in Daniel 2, verse 32, in the phrase, "its belly and thighs of brass." Now, this phrase is part of a description of a body, and it denotes the lower torso down through the uppermost portion of the legs of a statue. Seen in a dream recorded in Daniel 2:33, it refers to the statue's legs as being different from its thighs. So, in other words, the ancient Hebrew word for thighs that we see in Genesis 49:13 includes the pubic area. On this specific application, I wish to acknowledge the assistance of the late Dr. Charles Dorothy, a graduate of Claremont Graduate School, who checked the above analysis for accuracy. How could such a reference point to modern Holland today? Well, the Dutch capital of Amsterdam is world famous for its red light district. It offers all kinds of erotic, sinful pleasures in its various sex shops. The CBS television program 60 Minutes featured in its 1990-91 season a program about the Amsterdam sex district, which included prostitutes openly peddling their bodies to customers just behind windows at street level. In 1992, the Dutch Parliament effectively legalized the prostitution industry by repealing a law which previously had banned pimps. Dr. James Dobson's magazine Focus on the Family described how blatant the Dutch tolerance of sexual immorality has become. And in an article entitled "The Low Country Sinks Lower" by Tom Nieven, he states the following, quote, "Full nudity is common on Dutch television after 9 p.m. One can find pornographic movies on television during weekends. Homosexual marriage is legal in Holland. Supermarket racks are full of magazine covers featuring photos of nude women, all in plain view." Unquote. Now, the ancient Sidonians were famous for sponsoring and tolerating sinful sex practices, which were part of the fertility cult worship associated with Baal and Ashtaroth. The wicked queen, Jezebel, whose name is synonymous with brazen sexual temptation, was a Sidonian, spelled with an S, S-I-D-O-N-I-A-N. Now, a dictionary lists one meaning of the word Jezebel as any shameless, wicked woman, unquote. Now, official Dutch tolerance of a major industry featuring sexual sins parallels the Sidonians' tolerance of similar practices and would give meaning to the Genesis 49 prophecy about modern Zebulun being comparable to the sexually sinful Sidonians. The Netherlands perfectly fulfills the biblical prophecy about a modern seacoast nation that is a sheltered from the sea, has sucked the sea dry in an area, has a major seaport, and a sex industry like that out of ancient Sidon. That a prophecy thousands of years old has come true to accurately in the latter day period for which it was intended gives further testimony that there is, in fact, an all-powerful God who can accurately foresee the future and is capable of manipulating international geopolitics and creating and producing these effects. The Bible evidence clearly indicates that the Dutch are the modern Zebulunites, the descendants of Zebulun. All right, so the Dutch over here have sucked the seas, and they have produced, if not the world's largest oil company, it is certainly one of. It's one of the five sisters, the so-called five sisters, they call them. Let's take a look here at the tribe of Asher, A-S-H-E-R, next, A-S-H-E-R. Asher. But I'll tell you what, let me give us our mid-break reminder, and then I won't have to do that in the middle of the Asher story. It's just about that time to remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct at 417-273-4967 and ask for it. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or the publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. Now, most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Which means, in short, that doesn't mean just because I review a book that I agree with every word that's in it. Sometimes I get a letter from somebody and they'll say, "That was a mistake." Well, when I'm reviewing a book, I review those errors and those mistakes. That's the view of the author. That's the evidence that's being presented. And in the case of Mr. Collins, he's got a couple of conclusions in here that I disagree with. And from time to time, I'll probably point those out. But by and large, I've never read any book on the tribes of Israel that can come close to what this guy has produced. So just because I don't agree with or I make a citation here, don't think that it's necessarily cast in cement. And then finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. But they should. As one famous news guy said. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. That's the email place to go, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct on the landline at 417-273-4967. I guess while I'm at it, I should give a plug here for Mr. Collins. When I review somebody's books, they're copyrighted material. And I call these people and I say, "Would it be all right with you if I go ahead and review this?" And most of them will say, "Well, certainly. We would appreciate you selling our books." Now, do not send me any money and don't try to buy these books from me, because this is not a bookstore. This is a law school. But and Mr. Collins, I'm sure, does not want to sell books out of his home. Now, the reason that I'm giving you his home address is because he gave me a special deal. And I appreciate that special deal. Ordinarily, authors and publishers give me their books to review, free, gratis, doesn't cost me anything. This guy wouldn't give me a book, he made me buy them. But he said, "I'm going to give it to you at a discounted price, but I have a contract with my publisher. And my contract with the publisher prohibits me from selling books in competition with the publishing company." Well, that makes all the sense in the world. I can understand a publisher, you know, taking on a project like this, and they're going to print a run of books, 10, 20, 30,000 books. And they got to sell those books in order to make a profit. And then if they've got their author out there discounting them and selling them out of his home, you know, that's a problem. And so I sent Mr. Collins a $100 bill, and he sent me all five of his books. That's $20 a copy. I think that's a hell of a neat deal. I did not go through the publisher, so I can't tell you what the publishing house charges. So why don't you find out? If you want to buy one book, remember the book that we're reviewing this week to see if you like the book. It's called Israel's Tribes Today. Where are they located today? Now, I'm only hitting, and by the way, I want to point out, I'm only hitting the tip of the iceberg here. I'm just going right to the nut, and I'm going to identify these 10 tribes for you in this series of programs. There's many other chapters here in the books, the bibliography. Where does this guy get this information? Once in a while, I'll get a letter, you know, from somebody that challenges me and says, "Where in the hell did you get that? That's nonsense. That's crazy." And so I like to point out, well, I got it from USA Today. I got it from In Plain Sight, and then I like to cite the books and the dates and times and places and facts and witnesses and evidence. And this guy Collins has done that. I'm looking here at the bibliography, and he cites Reverend J.H. Allen, Judas Scepter, and Joseph's Birthright. And he cites Charles M. Boland and Henry Bradley and Frank Brown and Thomas Burns. And these are books, these are history books, like A History of the Ostrogoths, Indiana University Press, Bloomington, 1984. So this guy is not just talking off the top of his head. This is not a novel. This is not an entertaining book that you pick up, you know, and you go sit down on the toilet and sit there and want to read. He's citing from historians like Strabo and the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia and so on down the line. And he has masterfully combined these historical sources with Bible prophecies. And with the clues that are set out in the Bible, we're going to take a look here at this book of Asher, this tribe of Asher, in this book here called Israel's Tribes Today. How would you find Asher today from the clues left in the Bible? I wouldn't have a clue. I couldn't find him with both hands at high noon with a road map. But this guy Collins went through the Bible, gleaned out, you know, from the code. Remember this book now, the Bible, is written in code. And the code is revealed in Isaiah 28, verses 9 through 13. He says, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little. And I mean, the Bible is a big, thick book, you know, it's 1,189 chapters, and you got to go through that and pull out these clues. And I'm telling you, this guy Collins has done a masterful job of pulling these clues together and identifying these nations today. God hid it. Collins uncovered it. In fact, there's a prophecy, it's actually a proverb that Solomon wrote. And he said, it's the honor of kings, or how do you word that? Now he said it's to the honor of God to conceal a matter, and the honor of kings to search it out. And this guy has searched it out. Now, the reason I'm going to give you Collins' home address is that I think that he will probably make the same deal with you. Now, I didn't talk to the guy. You know, if you call him up, or if you send him a letter and he sends your money back and says, go buy the book from a publisher, don't get mad at him now. But when I wanted to review his book, I said, send me these. And I said, how much? And he said, $100 will cover the postage and the books. So if you send him a $100 bill, I'm pretty sure he's going to send you all five of them. Now, they're called the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found. This one, the last one, Israel's Tribes Today, identify with greater detail where they're located and the national histories of these countries. And then he's got Parthia, and then Israel's Lost Empires, and then the origin of ancient Israel, the origin and empires of ancient Israel. Now that book, The Origin and Empire, is the one that takes you over here to the New World and shows you, like, America BC with Barry Fell, all of the monuments and all of the signs. I mean, there are hundreds. I'm going to use the word hundreds of monuments here in North America. These mounds, for instance, that are out here on the Mississippi River, everybody's looking at them and saying, what are they? They're earthen mounds. There's about eight of them. And they're about 400 feet high. And one of them, I climbed to the top of one of them out here. It's in Illinois. And it's a half an acre on top of a mound about 400 feet high in the shape of a pyramid. Now, where do you think that came from, and who do you think built that? It was the Israelites that built it, and it's a copy of the Egyptian pyramids. And there's about six or eight of them here. Everybody looks at them and they wonder. The park system says, well, it's not Indians. The local Indians didn't build these and we don't know who did. Well, Collins can tell you who built them and about when. Send him a $100 bill. The address is 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. You got that? Stephen Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. I think that'll get you all $5. Now, if you only want to order one book, like this book here I'm reviewing now, Stephen M. Collins, go to the publisher. It's BibleBlessings.net. It's an easy one, BibleBlessings.net. They'll probably tell you what the prices are and how to get them and what the shipping and handling is. Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, is this Bible Blessings outfit. P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code up there is 48068, 48068. Again, that's 48068. And I'm sure they're nice guys and great guys. If these books sold for $100 a piece, they'd be worth it. You can't buy this information anywhere. You're not going to get this from Archaeological Review. You're not going to find it in any other book. I've read dozens of books on subjects like this, and I'm here to tell you that if the price of this book was $100, remember I grade these books, I say this is a 1 in 100 read. You can read 100 books like this and pay $5 a book, $500 for 100 books before you'll find a book like this one. So that's why I'm recommending it, and it's a very high recommendation. All right, let's take a look at the tribe of Asher. A-S-H-E-R, write that down on your list. The country, South Africa. Now listen to this. Write down South Africa. And let's see if that's anywhere near what Collins says it is. Now Asher was born to Zilpah, the handmaid of Leah. The tribe of Asher formerly inhabited a territory in ancient northern Israel that neighbored Zebulun's territory. The Bible records very little about Asher, and the prophecy of Genesis 49:20 is also very brief, stating, "Out of Asher his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties." Let me read that to you again. This is a clue. It's like playing a game on television. This is God speaking. He says, "Out of Asher his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties." With that clue, could you find the tribe of Asher in the world today? I've already told you it was South Africa. South Africa. That's because I read the book and I got the answer. And you too can have the book and then read the answer in this book here called Israel's Tribes Today. All right, at first glance, this prophecy seems unintelligible. However, an analysis is possible. The term Asher, Asher's bread shall be fat, indicates prosperity. But there are many prosperous nations in the world, and the specific clue will have to be found in the part about royal dainties. Now the word royal is based on the Hebrew word melek, M-E-L-E-K, which means literally a king. So the word yield comes from a Hebrew word literally meaning to give. And the Hebrew word translated dainties also means delights. And so when we utilize these alternate literal meanings, this phrase states that Asher shall give kings delights or yield kings delights. This, combined with some information from secular history, gives us a pretty good clue about Asher's identity today in the modern world. Now, the early histories of Great Britain record that during the reign of Kings David and Solomon, The Israelites had a voracious appetite for metals and natural resources for the Temple of God and Solomon's numerous building projects. Now, the Phoenician alliance led by Israel actively exploited the mineral resources of the British Isles, mining tin and other commodities. Well, at this time, Phoenicia had many miners in the British Isles, and there is evidence that a large contingent of the tribe of Asher was present in the ancient British Isles. In Numbers 26, verse 45, it records that one branch of the Asherites was named the Heberites with the root consonants HBR. An early English name for Ireland was Hibernia. And there is a group of islands off of the coast of Scotland named the Hebrides. H-E-B-R-I-D-E-S. Hebrides Islands. Both names include the consonants HBR, the root word of the Asherite clan named Heber, H-E-B-E-R. Now, these Asherite names in the early British Isles indicate that Asherites were active in the British mining activities of ancient Israel. So the tribe of Asher was engaged in mining. They were miners. Given the possible association of the Asherites with mining, it indicates that we should look for the Asherites among the prominent mining nations of the world. But, again, there are many such nations of the world which are mining nations, and it would help to know what they are mining, and this clue is given in Genesis 49:20, the prophecy that their latter-day nation yields royal delights. Yields royal delights. Now, the Bible was written during ancient times when kings were the heads of state. When gifts were given to kings, what was usually given as a royal delight? The primary gift to an ancient king was always an offering of gold. When Solomon was visited by the Queen of Sheba and other monarchs of the earth, they brought innumerable gifts of gold to Solomon. Ancient history is full of instances where tribute money was paid to ancient kings of many nations and empires in the form of gold. When nations were defeated, their gold treasuries were taken by their captors. Other precious metals and gemstones were also highly valued as gifts, tribute money, or booty. But gold was the preeminent royal delight. When the Magi visited Jesus as a child, gold led the list of gifts that they brought to him. Now, to locate modern Asher, we need to find a prosperous nation either in Europe or founded by people from European nations, which is particularly known for the mining of gold and other valuable metals and gemstones. Gemstones, such as maybe diamonds. Well, the Republic of South Africa meets all of these criteria. While Canada, Australia, and the United States are all prominent mining nations, they have already been identified. South Africa is the dominant gold mining nation in the world, and also is a dominant producer of platinum and diamonds. The South African name, De Beers, is virtually synonymous with diamonds and gemstones. Ancient kings frequently studded and decorated their crowns and gold objects with gemstones. The Republic of South Africa was colonized primarily by a mixture of British and Dutch people, the Boers. Since ancient history indicates that the Asherites settled in the British Isles, one can understand how Asherites could have migrated to South Africa from Great Britain. However, what about the Boers, also known as Afrikaans, A-F-R-I-K-A-A-N-S? Afrikaans, I guess that is. Now, in ancient Israel, the tribes of Zebulun and Asher lived side by side and may well have migrated together into Asia and Europe. Now, even as Manasseh and Ephraim migrated together into Europe before splitting into separate nations, other tribes could have done the same thing. In Amos 9, verse 9, it quotes God as saying, "I will command, and I will sift the house of Israel, the northern 10 tribes among all of the nations, like as corn is sifted in a sieve, and yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth." I want to pause here and make an observation because I've mentioned this many times in my law classes, that the Israelites that you see in the United States today, and oftentimes students come to class and they'll say, "Well, I'm from Italy," or "I'm from..." I had a guy here not too long ago, he was from Italy. And I looked at this guy and I said, "Son, you're not an Italian." And he looked at me like, "What do you mean I'm not an Italian? I'm telling you, I'm an Italian." And I said, "Well, I can just look at your features and see that you're an Israelite." Now, Italians, you know, I was raised in Humboldt County, California, and I worked on those dairies down there with the Portuguese and Italians and the Danes, and I'm pretty familiar with what Italians look like. And this guy was obviously not an Italian. So he went back and he took a look in his history, in his family's history, and he discovered that, yes, he's from Italy, but the tribe that he came from is from a place called Tuscany. And that the Tuscans, or the people from Tuscany, were Israelites that came up to Italy under Hannibal and got cut off there. They were captured there, and they were ultimately assimilated into the Roman Empire, and they're just a little group of people, and we have them here in the United States. You know, you could take the Navajo Indians. Now, those Navajo Indians are not Americans. Or put another way, if they're the Americans, well, then the whites here aren't. You know, so we hang labels on people, you know. We say, "Well, the Navajo Indians are Americans. And so are the Texans, they're Americans." Well, listen, the Texans and the Navajos are just as physically divergent as any two people can be. The fact that they were all born here in the United States and they're all Americans politically, just like this fellow living in Italy, you can look at him racially, this guy is not a Navajo Indian. Racially, this guy is not an Italian. Racially, this guy is an Israelite. And you'll find those little pockets of people all over the world today. And you'll find blacks and Turks in Germany, but that doesn't mean that they're... And they're German citizens, born and raised in Germany. But, you know, you take a look at a Turk in Germany, he says, "Well, I'm a German." You can take a look at that guy and say, "No, you're not a German. You may have German citizenship, you may have been born in Germany, but racially you can identify these people, and you can racially identify Israelites. Israelites are a very distinct racial group of people. And then within that racial group of people, there are very distinct people. The Dutch people with their blonde hair, I mean, you know, you go to Pennsylvania and you take a look at these people and they're just very obviously Israelites with blonde hair and Dutch. Now, go to France and all those people have black hair. The French are very distinct from the Dutch. And you take a look at the Irish and the English and the Scots and... You know, they all look the same, all look alike, you know, as they do with Chinese. All those Chinese look alike. All those Orientals look alike, is the old saying. Well, maybe to an Englishman, maybe to us whites over here in the Anglo-Saxons, all of the Asians look the same. Those Asians are just as distinct and different as are we. And within those subgroups, those nationalities, you can see that by the curly hair that they have, or the straight hair that they have, or by their facial features. Now, you're going to see that here as we progress along. Now, here's Asher. This prophecy does not refer to the dispersa of the Jews, but the scattering of the 10 tribes of the house of Israel. Now, not a grain will be lost. Every Israelite from the Middle Ages or from ancient times to today is situated in an Israelite country. So when I see a guy over here and he comes, let's say, from Czechoslovakia, and he says, well, I'm a Czech. Well, that's all right. You're an Israelite that came from Czechoslovakia. You take people from Russia. They're not Israelites in Russia, but there are a lot of Israelites in Russia. And those Israelites have been filtered through the nations under this prophecy until they finally end up in Australia, New Zealand, or the United States or Canada or some other place. And that's what happened to the Asherites, and they ended up in South Africa. Now, this prophecy does not refer to the diaspora of the Jews, but to the scattering of the 10 tribes of the house of Israel, the so-called lost tribes among the nations of the earth. And the reference that not the least grain shall fall upon the earth means that God would not lose track of any Israelite tribes or families. Now, God is very capable of directing the migrations of nations and even families in order to fulfill that prophecy. Now, while the evidence points to the Caucasian South Africans as the modern tribe of Asher, other Asherites are likely still living in the British Isles and the Benelux region of Europe. Now, the Union of South Africa was long a part of the British Empire, dominated by the tribe of Ephraim. Other Ephraimite nations founded by England, such as Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, have been content to stay British without any rebellious war for independence. However, the 13 original colonies of the United States and the Union of South Africa fought wars against England to gain their independence. And this argues that neither nation was essentially Ephraimite in nature. And we've seen that the United States of America was the tribe of Manasseh, and South Africa's war against the colonial British indicates that it was mostly composed of another tribe of Israel as well. In Genesis 28, verses 13 and 14, God made this promise to Jacob, the father of the tribe of Israel. He said, I am the eternal, the God of Abraham, and thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. I'm going to have to leave it right there with that prophecy. We'll come back with more on Asher and South Africa next time, right here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Well, we got about 1 minute. So I'm going to give you a reminder that this guy's name is Stephen Collins. If you'd like the copy of this book, go to the publisher if you just want one copy. And it's BibleBlessings.net, P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. All right, if you didn't get that, try it again, BibleBlessings.net. P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. That'll get you one copy if you want to order one at a time. Send $100 to Stephen Collins. I gave you his address a little earlier, and he'll send you all 5 books autographed. Make sure you put in your request an autograph of my books. All right, we got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, remember our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.